This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good afternoon and welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Anita Rani. In a moment, the journalist Merope Mills on the preventable death of her 13-year-old daughter. The actor Sheila Atim on her new epic film, The Woman King. We take a look at the progress being made for women in the armed forces following the Atherton Review. And Liz Truss delivered her first speech as Prime Minister to the Conservative Party conference. We hear from the Impressionists, Jess Robinson and Jan Ravens, on capturing our new PM's voice. But first, Merope Mills' 13-year-old daughter, Martha, died in hospital in August 2021. She'd sustained a rare pancreatic trauma after falling off her bike on a family holiday and spent weeks being treated in a specialist unit in London where she developed sepsis. As she deteriorated, Merope and her husband were very concerned by some of the decisions about her care, but were told to trust the doctors. Martha was not referred to critical care until it was too late to save her. This wasn't a question of an overstretched NHS. The ward she was on was well-funded and there was a bed available in ICU. Merope, who is editor of The Guardian Saturday magazine, says her daughter would be alive today if doctors had not kept information from them about her condition because they would have demanded a second opinion. An inquest earlier this year concluded that Martha's death had been preventable and King's College Hospital has apologised and pledged to learn lessons from their mistakes. When Emma spoke to Merope for her only broadcast interview, she asked her what happened after Martha came off her bike on that summer holiday in Wales last year.
We first thought she was just winded. She kept saying, you know, she's a brave little girl, she kept saying, no, I'll be fine, I'll be able to get back on my bike. And she was kind of holding her stomach, and in the end, we realised she wasn't going to be fine. So I took her first to the minor injuries unit at the local hospital, and a nurse saw us. She lifted up her T-shirt and, you know, there was no blood, there was no cut. There was just this little red ring on her stomach, imprint of the handlebar. She called the doctor, described it on the phone, and the doctor said it was just internal bruising and he didn't need to come and see her. And even then I thought, should I insist he comes? And I didn't, but I did make a note of where the nearest A&E was because that hospital didn't have an A&E. I went back to the cottage. And then as the night went on and she was getting sicker and sicker, I thought, OK, we do need to go to A&E. So we drove an hour to the nearest hospital with an A&E, Aberystwyth. We were there all night and they did a load of tests. And in the morning, the doctor came in and said, I think she's got pancreatic trauma. I've only ever seen this in medical textbooks, and I was so grateful that she'd identified it, because the problem with pancreatic trauma usually is that it goes unidentified. And at that point, everything just seemed to work the way you want the NHS to work. She was helicoptered over the Brecon Beacons from Aberystwyth to Cardiff, which was the nearest major hospital. She was put in critical care there. People were really sort of looking after her. But there were only three specialist units to treat pancreatic trauma in the country, and the one in London is King's College Hospital. And so because we're from London, we were then helicoptered there. The ward that we ended up in, Rays of Sunshine, was very different to the other wards we'd been on, and your reading of what hospitals are like. It was very clean, very well funded, 18 beds, half of them private. You know, it was glass doors rather than curtains. Every cubicle had a bed that you could sleep on at night. So before, we'd been in chairs next to her bed, and suddenly we were in this extraordinarily, you know, I've read subsequently that it's a centre of excellence for liver and other patients in the country. It just seemed like we were in the best place.
And how long were you there for?
We were there 4.5 weeks, really, in total.
So a long time. Was it normal to be there that long?
Yeah, it's a complicated injury, but if they can't connect the two bits of the pancreas, what they actually do is that they manage it in children in a way that they don't in adults, and hope it will heal itself and keep a really close eye on it. Not close enough in Martha's.
And let's get to that, because she did start to deteriorate. What happened on the key day? Because I know there's a key day that she did deteriorate.
She'd started bleeding unexpectedly out of a line in her arm and a tube in her stomach. I know now that that's called a DIC, and it's a sign of severe sepsis. But we were told this is just a normal side effect of infection, and her clotting abilities are slightly off. And always reassured for days. After a few days of that, they gave her a lot of clotting products and it eventually stopped. And then she started to seriously deteriorate over the bank holiday weekend, which is exactly one of the things I'd worried about enormously. Because we'd been there for 5 weeks, and you get to understand the rhythms of the ward and the hospital. And the ward took on a totally different atmosphere at a weekend. Mm. It was much quieter. The consultants came in earlier to do their ward round and then went home on call, so you didn't see them again. And so realising she had this bad infection and the bank holiday weekend that was approaching, I'd said on the Friday to the consultant, I actually said it. Partly you think saying it means it wouldn't happen. I said, I'm worried about her going into septic shock on a bank holiday weekend and none of you will be here. But the consultant said she wasn't worried about sepsis. Last thing she said to me on a Friday was it's just a normal infection and she was going to pop back and see Martha next week. The Saturday, another consultant came in because the consultants changed all the time. He said, this is what it's like with this injury. Infections come and go. The Sunday is the key day. She had a very high temperature. She couldn't stand. You know, she was dizzy. She was in a terrible way. And then she got a rash. And that really set me on high alert, because I knew that a rash was a red flag for sepsis. The consultant wasn't there. I stood over her on one side of the bed and the doctor on the other side of the bed and said, I'm worried this is a sepsis rash. I can just see her little eyes looking up at me, sort of panic, because it was a very fine line as well, trying to express your concern but not worry her, because she was nearly 14. She understood everything that was going on. And he said he didn't think it was a sepsis rash. It was a delayed drug reaction. And then he disappeared. And I didn't really see him again. I know he was talking to the consultant at home. I've subsequently learnt. Twice he called the consultant at home. The consultant decided Martha didn't need a critical care review.
Yes.
He said it would only increase my anxiety. No review was necessary. I obviously believe that that review could have saved her life, and that was exactly what she did need.
Because she did end up going into ICU.
Yes, the next morning. So that night, I lay with her all night. She drank crazy amounts of water. The nurse kept coming in. I kept saying, she's drinking unbelievable amounts of water. She came in. I said it twice. The doctor that was on duty on the ward, having been told, I now know, that Martha was the illest patient on the ward, didn't come and see her once. I'll never understand that decision. Whether she was told to avoid us because of my anxiety. But nobody came to see us. The nurse kept coming in, taking her observations, which I know were bad. And at 5 in the morning, she needed the toilet. And she got out of bed, and I was just helping her, and she had an enormous seizure in my arms, just sort of shaking her eyes rolled back in her head, and it was pretty terrifying. And I screamed for the nurses to come, and three of them came, and she came round. They made a fuss of her. They did a blood test at that point, a sepsis-related blood test, which they hadn't done the night before. The notes say that the doctor that was on duty had said, "Oh, I'll do it in the morning." And it was quite obvious at that point that she had very bad sepsis, and then she was rushed to ICU. And within a few hours, we were sat down and told she's in high danger of death. And a day later, she was dead. Septic shock.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. The really shocking thing for us is the extent to which we were kept in the dark about things that were going on in Martha's care. I've learnt so much. You know, I should say I'm no expert on hospitals or healthcare. I can only speak from my experience, which was the experience on one ward in one hospital, and no doubt it's a slanted one. But I've learnt an enormous amount about hospitals and how things are run in the year since Martha's death, and my eyes have been opened, and I feel emboldened to talk about it because of the number of clinicians, doctors, consultants who've contacted me since I wrote a piece about what happened to her, saying that I have correctly identified the problems and patterns of behaviour that led to her death, things that went so catastrophically wrong that could have been prevented.
Because that's what's very important to state here. Her death could have been prevented. And you speaking today again, it's not something I know you feel particularly comfortable to do, is driven by how important it is for people to hear that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like the systems to change. I believe people say that they are already changing.
I mean, there's a statement here from Professor Clive Kay, the chief executive of King's College Hospital, NHS Foundation Trust, talking about the article you refer to that you wrote, saying it's moving and profound. It describes a young life tragically cut short. I am deeply sorry that we failed Martha when she needed us most. Our focus now is on ensuring the specific learnings from her case are used to improve the care our teams provide, and that is what we are committed to doing. But almost before we get to the future and maybe lessons being learned, when you look back on the conversations you were or were not having, the things you didn't feel you said, or perhaps how you were received, what do you want to say about that?
I feel very strongly that we were kept in the dark, that we were patronised, that we were managed. I think that that is the case with a lot of parents in hospital, that there's a sense that the general public, first of all, couldn't possibly understand the intricacies of complicated care, to which I would say, this is my child, try me, I'm going to understand it. We weren't told the full picture. We found out things after she died. We weren't part of the team of people looking after Martha, and I think all parents should be. There's a sense that parents need to be controlled, because otherwise they might make too much of a fuss. And we can see from the medical notes about Martha that include references to me, to my distress, to my anxiety, that justified anxiety, I think we should say.
Yes.
That I was in some way being seen as a hindrance when I was trying to express my alarm that things weren't going well.
Because also, you've written about that some of the staff's attitudes reeks of misogyny, that perhaps you were treated differently as the mother, as the woman.
Yeah, I do feel that, because the medical notes included references to my distress, and one of the arguments for not sending critical care to come and look at her at a really crucial point in her illness was my anxiety. My husband and I took turns to be by Martha's side 24 hours each. And obviously, more than once, I have wondered if he had been there that night, a man who looks and sounds similar to most of the consultants that treated her. I'll never know. And obviously, I have a sense of guilt that whatever the right balance to strike was in kicking up a fuss, I didn't achieve it.
And yes, I know you also were tempering what you were saying. You weren't always saying what you were thinking or feeling, because we do grow up in this country with a deference for doctors. The NHS we're hugely grateful for. There's a cultural element to what we say and what we don't say. So even when you were saying it, you felt perhaps it wasn't being received. But there's so much more I know you've also thought about you should have or could have said.
Yeah, I mean, Martha ended up in hospital 2 years after COVID. You know, we'd clapped and banged pots with everyone. The whole conversation was about heroes, what heroes of healthcare there were. And I went into the whole experience naively trusting doctors a lot above my own perception. We are simply, as a society, not brought up to distrust doctors, to question them, to make a fuss. And obviously, I doubted myself over their experience, but I now really believe we need to stop this deferential attitude towards doctors. If I can, I'd like to say, read this as well, which is a tweet from a doctor someone sent me after I wrote that piece, which says, telling new medical students that they're in the top 0.1% is a big contributing factor to the sense of entitlement that oozes from our profession right now. Obviously, of course, there are lots of wonderful, self-sacrificing model doctors working today, and I certainly don't want to tar everyone with the same brush. But there is also a deep-seated problem of arrogance and overconfidence and doctor knows best that I think we need to challenge.
I wanted to just pick up on the fact that, you know, you said this at the beginning about the ward you were on, but you've been very clear that what happened to your daughter was not a result of underfunding, of crisis, of some of the usual political points, if you like, that are made about why things have happened or gone wrong. It's also worth pointing out there are 150 preventable deaths a week in the NHS, you know, and there's other figures as well we can talk about, but you're saying this is clear of that.
Yes, I'm saying it, and the hospital have admitted as much as well. It's, like I said, it was a really well-funded ward, quite different to all the wards we'd been on before. When I say that, by the way, we weren't medical parents, meaning parents whose children have been ill their whole life and know how hospitals work. We weren't then. We had no experience of that. And that was one of the reasons we were so naively trusting, because we didn't know to identify the problems. We weren't used to how things worked.
But I think that's how a lot of people go into hospital. They trust and they go in and they want to lean into the system and want to be cared for. And there'll be people listening to this thinking, please don't blame yourself. The way you're saying things like, I've gone over again and again in my head, would things have been different if Paul had been there, if it hadn't been me? But there is a part of you that sounds very strongly like you're still going over that, if I may say.
Yeah, I have extraordinary guilt about it. Anyone would if they'd lay next to their child as they lay dying in hospital. I play the tape over and over again, just wanting to press pause and do the thing that would have changed the outcome.
Yes.
I do feel that. And I know people will say it's not your fault. And it isn't. Believe me, I blame the hospital more than I blame myself. But I didn't intervene and manage to protect my child, the number one duty of a parent, when she was in danger. And that will be with me forever.
What would you say to any parents who are listening now, or the relatives of loved ones that perhaps they're trying to support through hospital at the moment?
I would say trust your instincts. Talk up if in any doubt. Get a second opinion, get a third opinion. I think Google is your friend. When Martha got the rash on the Sunday night and the doctor said he thought it was a delayed drug reaction, I started Googling sepsis rash, and some pictures came off my screen, and Martha, you know, I'd been by her side for some weeks and I was trying to work some of that time, and she said, why are you on your computer now? And I didn't want her to think I don't trust the doctor. So I just said, I'm sorry, darling. I shut it. And I went out to say to a nurse, I'm worried he's got this wrong. I'm worried it's a sepsis rash. And she stopped and she put her hand on me and she said, don't Google things. You'll only worry yourself. Trust the doctors. They know what they're doing. A year after the fact, I am still absolutely furious with King's College Hospital and the individual clinicians that let my daughter die a very frightening and painful death right in front of their eyes.
You wrote in your piece the most beautiful line where you talked about it's still hard to break the lovely habit of her talking about your daughter.
Yeah.
She sounded absolutely lovely.
She was so lovely. She was so lovely. Do you know, living with a child for 14 years, she died just 4 days before her 14th birthday. And you know them so well. And they are right on the cusp of really living. And Martha was warm and she was witty and she was bright and she was determined. But above everything, she had so much joy in the world. She brought so much joy to the everyday and she found so much joy in the everyday. And she was a pleasure to parent.
Merope Mills there talking about her daughter Martha. Many of you have read the article to which she refers, which is available on The Guardian's website, the paper where she works as an editor. And many of you contacted the programme after listening to that very powerful interview. Julia wrote in to say, I've never contacted Woman's Hour before, but have just listened to Merope Mills. What an inspirational lady and how brave to talk about what happened to help prevent another similar tragedy. I cried a lot. Bev says, such a tragic and heartbreaking story, but such an important message. Hierarchy, deference, complacency and the insularity of a system can lead to terrible decision-making in a high-risk situation, and it's something I've seen often in my work in the NHS. Carolyn emailed to say, I so hope that Merope speaking out will mean a healthier partnership between doctors and patients and their carers in future. I hate the overworked phrase, lessons will be learnt, but I really hope they are. And Sarah says, what happened to Merope and her family is the worst thing imaginable, and through all the pain and suffering, she is helping the other mothers, fathers, anyone to avoid the same thing happening to their loved ones. Martha sounds like the best daughter, best person. I will remember her every time I need the confidence to trust my instincts and speak my mind. Thank you, as always, for your comments. And if you'd like to get in touch with the programme about anything you hear on the show or anything you may want us to discuss on the programme, you can email us by going to our website. Now, Sheila Atim is not only an award-winning British Ugandan actor, but a musician, writer, singer and composer who's fast becoming a famous face around the world. In her new film, The Woman King, she plays the warrior Amenza, part of the Agoge, an all-female army who battle fearlessly against marauding European slavers to protect their empire in 19th century Dahomey, West Africa, now called Benin. More recently, you may have seen Sheila in the series about slavery in America, The Underground Railroad, and last summer she appeared in a West End revival of Nick Payne's quantum physics rom-com Constellations, for which she won an Olivier. But now, as Amenza, she is spiritual advisor to the king and long-standing lieutenant to Naniska, played by Viola Davis, the formidable head of that female military regiment. She acts, she sings, she's got a biomedical degree, she's a triple threat. I started by asking Sheila to tell us who the Agoge tribe were.
They were an all-female warrior unit in 1800s Benin, Dahomey, and they were the king's guard. They were the fiercest warriors in Africa at the time, and they served to protect their king, protect their kingdom, and protect each other. They were often young girls who had been cast out from society. They were deemed unwanted, unmarriable, not sort of fit for other women's duties. And so, yeah, they had a choice to, as you see in the trailer, Naniska says, you fight or you die.
Mm. And it's a story we have never seen on screen before. So when you got the script, What was your first reaction?
Well, I knew I wanted to do it because I'd heard about the project before. So I'd heard that it was being made. I heard that Viola was cast. I heard that Tusa Mbedu was also cast, and she was the wonderful lead in The Underground Railroad. So when they asked me if I wanted to audition, I was like, well, I want to be a part of it in some way. It's just about figuring out how.
Did you have to audition? Did you have to audition?
I did. Not everybody did, but I had to audition. But the wonderful thing was that the editor of Bruised, a film that I did for Netflix, starring and directed by Halle Berry, was edited by the wonderful Terry Lynn Shropshire, who also edited The Woman King. So she was the one who kind of suggested me to Gina Prince-Bythewood, the director, for the role. And Halle was actually kind enough to release some of the footage as part of their pitch to me, to Sony, to say that we really want this girl to play the role. And the film Bruised hadn't come out yet. So, yeah, there was a bit of a process of kind of getting everyone on board. But it was very quick. I found out within a couple of days.
When you heard that this is a story that's going to get made. Oh, and also, you know, you just got Viola Davis's name attached to it. I mean,
exactly.
I was going to say these films don't come around very often. These films don't come around. This is it.
Full stop. Full stop. I mean, there were so many elements. Viola, Gina, the story, Tussaud, the time as well. I think the timing, you know, everything is in its time, I believe. And we were coming out of a pandemic. I just finished doing Constellations in the West End, as you mentioned earlier. And that was one of the first shows to reopen the West End in the COVID pandemic. So it felt like a really kind of tentatively ambitious time to be making things again and doing so with the full force of production in a way that the pandemic hadn't necessarily allowed people to do for 2 years. So it felt right.
You are a tribe of warrior women. You are hard as nails. And your character is a spiritual advisor as well as, you know, the right-hand woman of Naniska, the warrior leader. You are soldiers, but also you are women, and we see sisterhood and we see a relationship that we don't see between women ever on screen.
Yeah, that was fundamental to the telling of this story. I think all of us knew that even before we discussed it. We were all jumping at the chance to create a story that had these 360 characters, these 360 women. As you say, it's not always something that you get in a project. We're often turned into an ideal or, you know, a very sort of unfleshed out version of what we could be. Our backstories don't matter. We're fulfilling a particular gaze. So to know that we would have the chance to explore all of that, that we wouldn't just be devices in someone else's story, but that we would all have our own stories within this larger story, was just extremely exciting. And, you know, we formed that bond in real life as well. Yeah, it's been a real joy, not just to work with these other women, but to also do the press tour with these women, to discuss the project with them, to hear their opinions and their reflections and to share ideas and also to just see them dressed up in nice clothes. You know,
I mean, I was just going to say that I'm clinging on to all the entire press tour because it's great to hear you all talking together, but also to see what you're all wearing because you look incredible and to, you know, to see you all out there doing that. Let's talk about the physicality of this film because you are warriors. Like I say, you're hard as anything. How much training went into it?
Lots. we trained before we started the project, we trained during the shoot. We trained every day. We did an hour and a half of physical training with our personal trainer, Gabby McLean. And then we would do maybe 2.5 to 3 hours of stunts with the stunt coordinator, Danny Hernandez. And that was pretty much standard. So yeah, you were sore for 5 months, if not more. but it was necessary, and it was, you know, Gina had set us the challenge and said, I want you to do your own stunts. She's a real advocate of women on screen being athletic. She was an athlete herself, and she really wanted us to, you know, display physical prowess as much as possible. And you can just shoot it differently. You can just capture all of the action.
But you are powerful in it, and it is very powerful to watch. Viola Davis said producing the film that stars
the three black women to get the financial backing for it was very difficult. How does it feel for you to be making cinematic history?
It feels brilliant because I still don't know what the ramifications of that will be, but I have high hopes for it. And I've now seen, now that we've done the press tour, I've now seen up close the responses from people, how it's affected them personally. You know, I've seen little girls dressed up as Ogogie before they've even seen the film.
That's because just, the costumes are amazing.
They're incredible. They're incredible. Gersha Phillips did a brilliant job as our costume designer. The things that people have said, even before the film was out, just again, the knowledge of this film existing, what that meant to people is so huge and so seismic and so much bigger than me or any of us as individuals who were involved in making this project. And I feel like that's, you know, if you're able to do that whilst also doing a job you love, and a job that is fun when it's not extremely difficult, then it's a win-win, really.
And The Woman King is on general release as of today. And if I may give you another recommendation, please search out Sheila Atim performing Tight Connection to My Heart from the play Girl from the North Country. Her voice is perfect. It will make you weep. And remember, you can enjoy Woman's Hour any hour of the day. If you can't join us live at 10 a.m. during the week, you can listen back, subscribe to the daily podcast for free via the Woman's Hour website. This week, we also featured an interview with the former lioness and now broadcaster Alex Scott. She's just released her memoir, How Not to Be Strong, and she spoke to Emma about the violence in her childhood and how she felt when she read her father's comments in the Daily Mail denying her allegations of abuse.
I can visualise it like it was yesterday. And that's the thing as well. So even when my dad left that environment, we never communicated or... You don't speak about it. It's like you try to move on with your life and leave that to the side, but it never leaves you. And that pain and the struggle still continues. And then I suppose as well, then those conversations with my mum don't happen. She doesn't know that her two kids are in the room hearing everything. She's trying to be strong in a totally different way. And we're trying to be strong for her, but can't help her. But like you said, the visuals are still so there. Yeah. I couldn't do anything.
And you also, as children, were, you say, subjected to similar sort of treatment and the experience of violence in the home.
Yeah, it's... Yesterday was hard because my dad's now done a story and it just hurts again. I think I'd have more respect for him if he just came out and admitted everything, you know?
Let me help you out with that, because overnight your father... has spoken to the Daily Mail.
Yeah.
He has denied ever being violent, but does acknowledge he was strict. One of the quotes to the paper was, he said, "I was never violent. That's not just me. I never beat Alex or anyone else in the family or did anything like that."
Yeah.
I wanted to give you the chance to respond to that.
Do you know what? Seeing here, I actually don't care what happened to me. I actually... Strict, if you're saying being beaten with a belt... It's just being strict. I can take that. I really don't care about me. What I do care is about my mum and the fear and the terror that she had to live in. And the fact that I was never able to help her in that. But what I can do is help her now by speaking the truth. And everything I wrote in that book, I stand by it, Emma, because it is the truth. And I almost feel angry at myself that I'm allowing him to hurt me again by those claims of lying. And I'm sorry. I feel sorry right now that I've not used my voice sooner to help my mum or any other woman that is in this position. But what he has done, he's lit a new fire in me yesterday. Because what I will do is do all I can to help women in this position so they don't have the feelings that my mum has carried her whole life or what I have. The fact of him doing that story, well, do you know what? I hope you're happy, because what I'm going to do with that book is, I don't even know if it will make money, to be honest. All that money will go to help women.
So many of you were moved by that interview. If you'd like to hear it in full, then please do listen back via BBC Sounds. And there are links on the Woman's Hour website if you've been affected by any of the issues in the programme. Now, you may remember our coverage of the Atherton Review by the House of Commons Defence Committee last year, which found evidence of sexual assault, bullying, harassment and a lack of mental health services for women in the armed services. The government accepted the majority of the findings and agreed to a review this year to check on what progress has been made in bringing about change. The Defence Committee is asking servicewomen to come forward with evidence as part of that follow-up and plans to report back on the findings in November. On Friday morning, I spoke to Emma Norton from the Centre of Military Justice, and I began by asking her to remind us of the findings in last year's report.
It was really, really shocking. And I think MPs and government and the Ministry of Defence were very, very shocked by some of the testimony that they heard. 4,000 women gave evidence to it. There was a lot of information, evidence not only just about things like ill-fitting body armour, health issues. Right, it went right the way through to really serious, pernicious sexual harassment and sexual offending, including very serious sexual offences. And a lot of women gave evidence that the systems that are in place to help them achieve justice or some sort of accountability or to bring complaints or to formally report them to the military police were just not working effectively, and they felt that they hadn't had justice. And then what you also saw was the consequences for those women that had been most seriously affected was that they lost their careers and that perpetrators were still serving in the forces.
Right, so really, really shocking things were found, as I said in the beginning of this, 64% of veterans, 58% of female currently serving experienced bullying, harassment, discrimination. They found that sexual discrimination is gendered, lack of faith in the complaint system, like you've just said. Really shocking statistic that rape case convictions within the military 4 to 6 times lower than in civilian courts.
Yes. And that doesn't seem to have changed. While the last year's statistics on rape at court-martial have improved, it's really important to acknowledge that, they are still far, far below the outcomes in the civil system, which are already, as you know, very bad. So it really is, they are getting really rock bottom justice in the military justice system. And one of the most powerful recommendations of the Atherton Review was that serious sexual offences like rape, sexual assault by penetration, but also child abuse, domestic abuse offences, must be taken away from the military justice system and should be sent to the civil justice system. And that follows a series of similar reviews and findings from independent judges, and the Ministry of Defence rejected that very quickly, as they have consistently rejected it, and I doubt very much that their position on that is going to change. And the other really important thing that came out of the Atherton Review was the need to take serious service complaints, those are the internal grievance processes that deal with bullying, harassment, discrimination, a disproportionate number of which of course affect women. Mm. Take them away from the services themselves, put them in a central defence authority. Now, this again is something that has been recommended year on year by lots of different independent reviewers. And again, they have not done it. What they've done, they have made some improvements and there is a lot of work going on. I really want to acknowledge that. But it is not, it's on their own terms. They will not give that level, that quality of independence that external advisors have repeatedly advised them to do.
Do we know why?
Well, you have to speculate, and it will be really interesting to know what they say about it. I mean, they always come up with some sort of fudge answer about, well, we have an independent ombudsman. But if you know anything about the system, you know that the ombudsman only gets involved right at the end of the process, by which point the damage has been done. I think there is a real concern about the level and the level of the problem. There's a failure to appreciate just how difficult and complex it is and the impact that it has on individual women's lives and careers. And taking it away from the single services, taking those complaints away from the single services would engender a huge amount of faith and trust, would mean more women would come forward and make complaints, because we know the majority don't even bother to make a complaint because they think there's no point. And that would then trickle down. It would then have consequences for people and would bring about more widespread change.
Okay, so things that they haven't done, which may take a lot longer. And like one of the things that did come out of the Atherton Review was the lack of faith in the complaint system. So women aren't even coming forward to make the complaints. So, but what changes have been brought about?
Well, there's a huge amount of work going on at a very high level in the MOD. So they have agreed, because because there was so much criticism and public concern about the refusal to hand rape cases over to the civilian system, they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to improve military policing. So what they've done is important, and it is, I'm sure, going to improve military policing, and that's got to be acknowledged. They're going to create an integrated, called a Defence Serious Crime Unit. It's not bedded in yet. It's not active yet, so we've got no way of knowing how effective it's going to be. And critical to that is going to be ensuring there is a very significant amount of civilian involvement in it, because that, when it was recommended by two independent judges to be set up, it was on condition that there would be important levels of civilian input, and we have no idea if that aspect of it has been accepted.
So take us through some of the experiences that women have faced during their time in service. How were they treated? Let's hear about the things that you are listening to.
Well, we gave evidence to the original inquiry, and we supported a number of our clients to give evidence through us to the inquiry. And the kinds of things they're describing are really serious sexual assaults on units by colleagues or by fellow service personnel. That once they make that report to the military police, there is, in every case that I've seen, really serious concerns about the quality of those investigations. So really basic failures in investigative processes. There have been serious concerns about the quality of the prosecutorial decision making. And these concerns that the women have raised with us have been reflected in all of these independent reviews of what's been going on. Then what women are describing are consequences for them inside their units, within their chains of commands, for having reported those kinds of offences. And that might range from quite deliberate hostility to just a complete failure to understand what it is like to have survived a sexual assault. Complete ignorance on some parts. And those women are then left to their own devices. And the other thing I would say is there is, in every single case that we have seen, a total failure to understand, apply, or even be aware of the policy on what commanding officers are supposed to do when somebody in their unit has reported being a victim of a sexual assault. Complete ignorance of it. So that is changing, because I think partly because these women are coming forward and basically banging on about it. But again, the burden is always on the women to make these changes and to carry them through. And it's a huge burden.
And you still need women to come forward. What can we read into that?
Well, exactly. And one of the things that concerns me and a lot of other people is that service women are not allowed to speak to Parliament unless they go and get consent from the Ministry of Defence, which, of course, is the very institution they would like to criticise. They have to go and get that consent first. Now, the original Atherton inquiry got consent from the Secretary of State for Defence for women to give evidence directly in writing only. It's really important to make that clear. They weren't allowed to speak to them, but in writing only, and they did. Now, we don't know if that concession continues to apply. And service women, service men and women, they generally follow orders. They don't break policy. They don't like to do that. And so it's really, really important that they have that reassurance that they can come forward, that that Parliament really does want to hear from them, and that there won't be repercussions. Obviously, there are independent charities like ours, and there are other organisations like Forward Assist and Aurora New Dawn, and they may also be able to help women give evidence if that's useful.
General Sir Nick Carter, who was the head of the armed forces, he said that they need to encourage a laddish culture to get young men and women to fight on the front line. What do you think about that?
It's so disappointing that somebody who's been in post for so long and with such authority said something like that. And to be fair to him, he did resile from his comments a few days later because there was such an outcry of it. It's totally the wrong attitude. This is a question of operational effectiveness. If you do not encourage women to join the armed forces, if you then treat them very, very badly and don't support them to bring about changes to improve the forces, that is what is compromising operational effectiveness. And you see this time and time again, when people like me, when Sarah Atherton, when other people were raising these concerns, in some quarters, it's dismissed as wokery, it's dismissed as, you know, diversity and inclusion, roll the eyes, all of that kind of stuff. And it's really, really important to show leadership on this, because it's absolutely, as they said, as the Ministry of Defence admitted, it is mission critical.
So what recommendations would you like to see from the government?
Well, it feels a bit like Groundhog Day because people are making these recommendations over and over again. I mean, I do want to emphasise that they are doing a lot internally. Mm. And these cultural change takes a long time to bed in. It will be really interesting and important over the next couple of years to see how it all further beds in. I still think, and many people still think, civil courts are the best way to go for cases of rape and serious sexual assault. You have got to take serious sexual harassment complaints and bullying and discrimination away from the services themselves. Do what review after review has recommended and take them away and put them in a central defence authority.
But for the change to take place, Emma, you need service personnel to come forward, women to come forward and basically explain and talk about their experience of what's been happening, particularly in the last year. So that's what this is about. We want to encourage women who might be listening today, who may have a relative or a friend who is serving, to encourage them to come forward to talk about their experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a huge opportunity. Thank you to Women's Hour for doing this, because there's been so little publicity around this. So this is a really, really good opportunity to get that message out. And if those women don't feel that they can come forward themselves, you can do it through a friend, you can do it through a colleague, you can do it anonymously, you can contact us. So I think it's really, really important to encourage people to come forward. Yes, please.
A Ministry of Defence spokesperson said, "We've made very positive progress in delivering change, and we absolutely are determined to keep improving the experiences of women in our armed forces. The House of Commons Defence Committee will hold an evidence session in order to assess the government's progress on the recommendations of the Women in the Armed Forces Inquiry Report that was published in 2021. We're encouraging serving personnel and civil servants to submit written evidence to the inquiry to inform the session and support our continued efforts to maintain momentum and keep delivering improvement for our women in the armed forces. And we will be following this story and hope to speak to the Defence Minister, Sarah Atherton, in the next few weeks. And a reminder, the deadline for getting in touch with the Defence Committee is October the 17th. And finally, it was a big week for the Prime Minister Liz Truss, not least with her first speech as Prime Minister to the Conservative Party conference. Here's a flavour of that speech, which focused largely on her government's pursuit of growth, but also included some of her own story.
I know how it feels to have your potential dismissed by those who think they know better. I remember as a young girl being presented on a plane with a junior air hostess badge. Meanwhile, my brothers were given junior pilot badges. It wasn't the only time in my life that I've been treated differently for being female or for not fitting in. It made me angry and it made me determined. Determined to change things so other people didn't feel the same way.
Well, it's been a busy week for the Prime Minister, but the Impressionists have been busy at work too, as they are around these times. Politicians have always been in their lifeblood, especially our PMs. Emma spoke to Impressionists Jess Robinson, who does many of the famous female voices for Spitting Image, and Jan Ravens from Radio 4's Dead Ringers. What did she make of Liz Truss's speech on Wednesday?
The big takeaway for me was like the contrast with her sort of demeanour from when you look back to her, you know, her famous pork markets and cheese markets, grinning around and sort of, you know, and which was where I sort of got my whole Liz Truss character, is that sort of, hello, you know, everybody, you're going to give me some applause now. And the whole thing has got this sort of soft grin. Whereas it was almost like she'd, you could see her trying so hard not to open her mouth and sort of narrow her eyes, so that she was sort of looking more kind of Bond villainy somehow. You know, there was a sort of like, she was sort of trying to establish some control over herself. And I thought there was a curious sort of contrast between her untrammeled self-doubt, which I think is, you know, was always there when she was this sort of, and it's still there, but she's having to sort of draw back on the kind of her her uninhibitiveness, kind of, so to speak.
That's interesting that perhaps as you get more senior, the voice will change. We've heard about that before, but because of what you're trying to do and mm-hmm. in the context of what's been a pretty difficult start to her tenure. Let me bring you into this, Jess, already laughing at what Jan's saying, perhaps with
such brilliant observations. Some awareness. This is fabulous.
How have you found your inner Liz Truss?
Well, I first started doing Liz Truss on the last leg when they asked me to do her when she was Foreign Secretary. And actually, nobody really particularly knew what she sounded like. They weren't that familiar with her. And I really liked her slightly nasal way of speaking and that croak that she's got and the slightly splashy S's. And it just all sounds, I love, Jan, your observation of her smile. It's like she can't believe she's there.
Exactly.
Isn't it? And we can't believe it either. And then when she became Prime Minister, they got me back on the last leg because they went, oh my God, that was actually really good. That is what she sounds like.
It must be quite a good moment to be women working in this field when we do get a woman in charge. And of course, not long ago, Jan, we had Theresa May, who you also had to get to know.
Well, yes. The thing about Theresa was like, by the time she left, I mean, I had done really well out of Theresa May and the whole kind of thing of her tension, because it is funny how characters reveal themselves to you. It's like Jess says, sometimes it's out of, you know, the way they say their L's or something like that. Or sometimes like with Liz Truss, for me, it was just this character, this kind of, you know, this little girl going, like me, like me. And with Theresa May, I found her so hard to get. Mm. Until I noticed this tension in her, and it was all about the tension in her demeanor, in her sort of inability to kind of play, her inability to kind of go, hey, let's have a drink, let's discuss it. You know, she wasn't clubbable, and that tension was in her physicality and in her voice and in her throat, which I think was why she coughed so much, because her, you know, if you have to do her voice for any length of time, you do start coughing. And it amazes me that politicians don't get more coaching.
Well, yeah, she had to be given a cough suite talking about conference speeches. I remember covering it live when all the letters fell off behind her. I was over on my Five Live show then. And, you know, I don't normally have to commentate during the middle of a speech, but she was being given a cough suite and I had to sort of fill in, because it's radio, the silence of how that was working. So it was kind of a very odd and memorable moment, and very different, I'm sure, from where you're sitting as well, when you have to think about how to get that voice. But it's interesting that the tension allowed you to unlock how to do her. Jess, for you, I mean, is there a tension, talking of that, when you are looking at how women are speaking and coming across, that, of course, you know, they're politicians like everyone else. They're now the prime ministers more and more slowly, but surely. But do you ever worry about undermining them or their policies? Is that ever a thought in your mind because of how long and how hard it has been to get women in those positions?
Oh, now you're making me feel guilty.
I'm not trying to.
No, it's not actually. I think that comes with their job. It's fair game. And there are, you know, when I'm doing some celebrities, for example, Amy Winehouse, and because I do lots of sort of singing impressions as well, there are some that you do treat as more of a tribute and with more sort of reverence or more affectionately, but not politicians. They are, you know, big enough to look after themselves. And if we can't laugh at them, I think we'll all cry, to be honest. So we, you know, I think they are fair game.
And you go for it. And Jan, it's now, I mean, we're looking across the cabinet, there's a new cast of characters again to get your head around. There's a lot of women in there again. And who are you thinking about? I could already see you exhaling, trying to get to grips once more with the new crew.
Well, I am sort of quite astonished by them. I mean, Suella Braverman is, yeah, I mean, I haven't got her voice yet, and it's not a particularly sort of idiosyncratic voice, but my God, the content, you know, this woman who has a dream of seeing, you know, asylum seekers sent off on a plane to Rwanda or refugee, you know, I mean, she sort of seems to be styling herself as a a Bond villain. I can't, and Therese Coffey is obviously a good night out from the looks of her. pictures of her with a cigar and a glass of wine. I haven't got to grips with them, but there's certainly this sort of, you know, this line of cronies on the front of the audience, that my brilliant, you know, Therese Coffey, who's going to be getting more ambulances, making sure you get a GP appointment. And I thought, God, don't promise too much. You know, she's promising that the ambulances are going to come on time, the doctors are going to get you an appointment. She's promising Ukraine will win. She's promising all these, making all these promises that she doesn't know she can necessarily keep. I did feel rather sorry for all these people on the front row who were then sort of being asked to kind of fulfil these promises.
Well, it's a completely different way, of course, of listening to political content and how to understand it and how to bring it to life and find the humour in it. Jess, a final one to you. Is there anyone you've never managed to nail in the political world, or one that you got after a lot of trying?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think I wish that I could do men. The only man I can do is a little bit of Joe Pasquale. But, I wish that we could also... I don't have the timbre in my voice. I can't... It sounds like the equivalent of Monty Python being ladies. Do you know what I mean? I just can't get my voice that low. But I would love to be able to do all of the male politicians, because they're fair game as well, and why shouldn't women be having a go at them as well?
Well, it's interesting to hear what you would hanker after, and also to get your take, the way that you watch and listen to these sorts of events, because it is going to be very different. Of course, at the same time, it is comedy. You poke it right across the political parties, the political spectrum, and you're listening to something that people, you know, want to get the content of, but equally they do also want to have some laughter in there, and it is a rich tradition. Jess Robinson, lovely to have you on the programme. Thank you. Jan, thank you to you as well. It's wonderful to hear you, as I say, in your own voice, as well as the ones that you're...
Yes, and I was actually, I just have to say, I was actually very pleased when you took over on Woman's Hour, Emma, because I could never, ever do Jenny Murray, because she was so deep and so throaty. And I also thought sounding like Joanna Lumley when I was trying to, Jenny Murray. So now you've taken over with that. So you've got that slight sort of, thing in there where it's like more kind of more right on-y and more kinds of, hi. So let's talk about a bit more,
I think you just have to get in, apparently, what I do always say, which I'm just trying to understand. So that's a terrible catchphrase.
Just trying to understand,
And I'm going to end Weekend's Woman's Hour by doing an impersonation of me. Join Emma on Monday from 10.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.